I'm Heidi Holton. It's Culturology on Northern Community Radio. I'm one of those people, my whole life, I have always had a book with me. A couple of books, just in case I finish one or one isn't exactly what I want it to be. I'm drawn to Minnesota authors. I'm also drawn to stories that I haven't read anywhere else. I've always enjoyed a story that is set back in time in Minnesota, and especially in Northern Minnesota, because it helps me learn about the people that came before me, my relatives specifically, but also the people that inhabited the land I now live on back then. Peter Guy is a Minnesota author who has written two novels. They've both been set on the North Shore. The newest one is out. It's called The Lighthouse Road. The Star Tribune reviewed Lighthouse Road and said that it emphasizes the importance of place in human destiny. Guy layers stories of two generations over one locale, drawing parallels while revealing gaps. That's a quote from a review written by James Selar for the Star Tribune. For me, it was the kind of book that I was drawn into the words of this story before this story even came together for me. I felt like I was kind of dipping my toe into some cold water, but then the story hooked me, and it was like I got shoved off the dock into the lake of this book. I had a chance to recently talk to author Peter Guy about The Lighthouse Road and asked him more about the importance of place and time in the story.
It's in a fictional town called Gunflint on the north shore of Lake Superior. I have, for all sorts of reasons, not least of which is for my own convenience, I've fictionalized all of the North Shore in my fiction. But Gunflint is roughly Grand Marais and is the biggest town in my fictional North Shore, north of two harbors. So that's where it is, roughly. There's all sorts of reasons to fictionalize a place, and I think that one of the big reasons that I've done it is because I didn't want to be beholden to any true history or any true geography or any real people in the book or in any of the stories that I write about the North Shore. So I guess that's why it's fictional.
Tell us about the time period that it's set.
The Lighthouse Road takes place. There's actually a couple of storylines are sort of interconnected and braided throughout the novel. And the first is in the 1890s, the mid-1890s, and it involves the story of a young Norwegian immigrant woman who comes to Gunflint expecting to find her aunt and uncle, but finding no one instead. And it's her story and what happens to her. And she has a son, and so his story is the other line, and that takes place mostly in the 1920s, although there are a few chapters from his childhood, and then one chapter that acts as an epilogue later than that in 1937. But I chose to set it in the far past for a couple of reasons. One, to accommodate the immigrant woman's story. But also, I discovered as I wrote that it was so far removed in time made my imagination just a much more fertile thing. And I found myself conceiving scenes and writing scenes with a sort of, I don't want to say an easiness, but I was just really transported myself in the writing. And I think that the part of that is that I was not beholden to any of the conveniences or anything about the world that I know. That is, there are no cell phones. There's very little in the way of modern conveniences at all, automobiles or electronics or anything like that, any of the things that dominate our lives now. And so it was just this, every time I went to the story, not only did I get to go up to the North Shore, but I got to go backwards in time like that as well. And it just sort of wiped out all those years and left me with just these people and just their secret lives. And boy, it was just fascinating to visit that epic in my mind.
So for you as a writer, did you go into it wanting to accomplish something, or did those people, those characters you created, kind of come to tell a story almost? Sometimes writers end up telling me things and it sounds like they've been overtaken by some other spirits almost when they write.
Yeah. I know what you mean. And for some reason, when I hear writers say that, I always think, oh, what baloney. I mean, certainly the author is responsible for not only the creation of the characters and the storylines that they come up with, but sort of any moral complications that arise with them or any emotional storylines that arise with them. And so I always think, no, you're... When I hear an author say that, I think, no, you're in charge of that. I should say I always did think that. But now I think I understand a little bit. To answer your question, when I started writing the book, I had in mind just the immigrant woman's story. I thought it would be a novel about her, and it would just be her story, and it would have been essentially half of the book that it is now. But what I discovered at the end of the first chapter, when she gives birth to her son, the book is told totally out of any chronological order. There's no linear timeline at all in the telling of it. But what I discovered is that as soon as that child was born, I felt some compulsion to tell his story. So I had a big plan about what was going to happen to her and all of the characters, or many of the characters that were going to be involved in her life, not least of which was this son, but I had no idea that he would become, and in most ways he actually overtakes the book and becomes the novel's main character. But so I was surprised to discover that he would be a part of the book. So the answer is sort of I had a plan, yes, and I executed part of that plan, but then other things came up along the way. And they surprised me. I won't give them credit for their own creation, but they did surprise me that I felt this compulsion to write about them.
We're talking with Peter Guy. His new novel is out. It's called The Lighthouse Road. So it is set in a different time period, as you said. So was there research involved before you got to the point of building characters?
Yeah, there was a lot of research involved. I mean, I know virtually nothing about being a young Norwegian immigrant woman or a whiskey smuggler or a boat builder or a commercial fisherman on the North Shore, any of those things. Although I had done a lot of the research almost unwittingly and have been doing it for many years, I've had an interest in the settlement of that part of the world and just in the people who live up there. And every time I'm up on the North Shore, I find a book about something. Sometimes it's a book about boat building or fishing or any of the things that just have sort of crept into this book. So I had done a lot of research without really realizing that I was doing research, without really realizing that I would be culling from this reading sort of the tropes that would eventually appear in this novel. So there's that part of the answer, but there's another part of the answer is that, like I said, I knew that Thea's story, Thea's the immigrant woman who comes from Norway, I knew what her story was going to be. So I had done most of the research on the logging camps and what that was like. And frankly, those logging camps and what life was like for those guys was, I mean, it may have even preceded her character and my imagining this story and the first sort of inklings that I had about this story. And I can't say why that industry and that time fascinates me so much, except that it's such a remarkable life that they led. And I think that just that and how contrary it is to the sort of comforts that I'm used to was really intriguing to me. But once I, you know, got into the book, there is, of course, you know, ideas pop into your head, and I wanted to make Ode, the main character in the book, a boat builder. And knowing very little about boat building, I had to immerse myself in that and really, in a sense, I mean, not that I could make a boat, but I understand very well now how some of the old boat builders went about their trade. There's a lot of medical information in the novel that I knew nothing about, but I feel almost as though I could perform some of the operations that are performed in the book, or at least while I was researching them. I was so immersed in it that I felt like, oh, if someone came in here right now and needed their eye removed, I feel like I could almost do it. I had that feeling. So there's that. There's definitely research along the way, and most of it is just tons of fun because it's so outside of our experience. The whole world of this book is so outside of our experience now. And in that way, it was just a way to, I guess, to connect with that time period and with the sorts of lives people were leading.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the eye because I wasn't sure. You never want to give away much about a book, but when I've been recommending this to my friends, and I am just actually stunned that I could not put down a book that was talking about an eye being removed. Or it's so graphic, but so compelling. I could not stop reading it, and I was sort of screeching as I was reading it. I don't know. I just had never read anything like that. And there's a bunch of, I was kind of looking back at it today at those sections, and there's different parts to the section on the eye. And actually the whole idea, and maybe I can have you talk more about this apothecary, because that's not a word we hear much nowadays, and it certainly served a huge purpose in Gunflint, Minnesota, right, at that time.
Well, about the eye, you know, it's so interesting to me how these things happen, at least for me, and it's interesting to me, and I hope you'll let me just elaborate a little bit. But when I was working on this character, when I first thought, oh boy, this guy's got to be a main character in the book, and I started just sort of imagining him and what he looked like and what sort of personality he had and, you know, his physical appearance and those sorts of things. I'm talking about Ode. One of the first things that popped into my mind was he has a glass eye. I want this guy to have a glass eye. And there's no rational reason for me to, or preconceived notion about what that might lend the book, what sort of interesting scenes that would lead to. And those sorts of things happen to me all the time. I don't often make these grand plans and look at the ways that these things can sort of spiral out into the rest of the novel, these details of a character's appearance or some of the, you know, grotesqueries that they might have. But they have a way of taking on a life of their own, and Ode has a glass eye, and I won't give away how he came to lose his eye, although I will say that it's my favorite scene in the novel. But just this notion that he would have the glass eye and that there would be all sorts of reasons to elaborate on that, not least of which is the connection that is made with Jose Grimm, who is one of the other main characters in the novel and who runs the town apothecary. And I knew that this character Grimm was going to be in the novel from the beginning, but I didn't know that he would take on such a large and prominent role in the novel, or that he would become such a sort of morally ambiguous center to the novel and sort of the character, one of a couple of characters that connects the mother and the son, because they never know each other. And so it was just this sort of notion that this man, Hosea, comes into town and in a way takes over a little bit of this town that's just being settled. There aren't a lot of people in Gunflint during the time of this story, but he becomes this sort of larger-than-life figure, and he's a very complicated man, but here he is running this apothecary. It was like a big Pandora's box full of strange notions and ideas and subjects that I could just bring in or leave out, and believe me, there were some even stranger subjects that were left out because of their strangeness, but it just became this sort of center of the town. And I love that idea, and it's based not entirely on fact. The history of Grand Marais, Minnesota, has its own share of interesting characters, at least from what I've read. And there were these sorts of shops and places of business that were more than just the place to buy the candles and the kerosene and the fine china, but also to buy the booze and the medicine and the curatives and all these sorts of things. And it just fascinated me. Another one of these things that's so far outside of our experience now. I mean, now if we need to aspirin, we go to Walgreens, and there you have it. There's 100 different ones to choose from. But in a town like Gunflint, in a time like then, you went to this man's shop, and this man had not only the aspirin, but all these other curiosities, and it just seemed like a great way to sort of, you know, amplify the strangeness of that time in contrast with our own experience now.
I think people, wherever they might live, would be drawn to this story because of how you've put it together. But I know, you know, when you live in a state and you find a novel that's about your state or is, especially if it's set in a different time period. For me, you know, I live in northern Minnesota now, but my generations before me, my great-grandparents were in the logging camps and that kind of thing, but I don't know their day-to-day existence. I don't know what it was like for them. And so for that reason, I'm drawn to a story like yours. Do you think this sort of some of these harsh realities that the characters that you've written about and that the people that came before us in Minnesota, where they came from, do you think that still has something to do with who we are?
I think that the answer to that is that absolutely. I mean, I'm not overly philosophical about this, but I mean, there's just no mistaking the fact that we are our ancestors' children, and so part of them lives in us, maybe a little bit less with each passing generation, and the more urban and comfortable we become, the more removed we are from their experience. Of course, that's true. But I think about my own ancestors and my own grandparents and family, and just the sort of when I think about my grandmother, for example, who lived into her mid-90s, and just the stories that she told and her demeanor. She was a bohunk, as she called herself, a woman from Central Europe, and she was just so stern and so sort of quiet but strong and interesting that way. And I'll find myself even still communicating with my kids and not realizing that I'm taking on aspects of her personality when I'm reprimanding them, say, or talking to them about some of the things that are important, things that they need to learn or things that they need to be respectful of, or those sorts of things. So of course we live as a result of those people that came before us. But I think it's so interesting how, even in my lifetime, now when you go up to a place like Grand Marais, if you're there on a nice summer weekend, it's practically like being at the state fair. It didn't always used to be like that. I mean, tourism as the main industry, I can't say exactly when it became the main industry up there, but now that town sort of, and a lot of the towns up there, of course they would exist otherwise, but their economy is really largely based on tourism. It's in contrast to a logging camp and a shipping and an industry built on shipping and boat building and fishing and sorts of things. So we're a long way removed from that. And I don't know if that's good or bad or inevitable or natural or what, but it's the way it is. I don't think that the Grand Marais now has much in common with the Gunflint of my story, if I can boil it down to that. And like I said, I don't know if that's good or bad or if we're wimpier because we go up there and eat the world's best donuts or have an ice cream cone on the harbor there or what. But it's different, for sure, I think.
Peter, what is writing life like for you? Do you write at a certain time of day? Are you able to get enough time in of what you would like?
Well, the answer is definitely not on the time matter. I have three young kids, an 8-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 3-year-old, and I'm my day job, if you will, is stay-at-home dad. So most of my time is spent making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and negotiating who gets to play with what Legos and those sorts of things. So my writing life is, though there is some stability in it, a couple of days a week we have someone come and watch the kids for a few hours and I write then, and I try to write every day on the weekends at least for a couple of hours. But otherwise I piece it in when I can. My wife went to bed early tonight, so I'll probably stay up late tonight and do a little bit of work, and I just squeeze it in whenever I can. And it used to be that I needed a very sort of strict schedule, and I needed complete silence, and I needed all these particular things, a particular sort of pen and a particular sort of paper, and my computer set up just so. But now it's become the sort of thing where I can write anywhere, anytime, and I guess it's just evolution. I'm just, because that's the only way that I'm able to write, that's how I have to write. So it's different. I would sure love to have 8 hours a day, 6 days a week to do it. I could do that, but I'm not so lucky right now.
That is Peter Guy. His new novel is called The Lighthouse Road. I really enjoyed reading it. I felt lucky I had a book like yours. I was recently had to take a flight. And when you get stuck with a book you're not really interested in, it's trouble. So I appreciated that. Thank you.
I know that feeling, yes.
Peter, thanks so much. I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Heidi. Thanks a lot for having me.